a few people from Jikoji about a week or so ago. We're down in Santa Cruz at the Zen Center for a talk by Kaz Tanahashi on the Heart Sutra. And Cliff was one of those. And when then he heard I was coming up here, he said, if you don't have any other topic, maybe you could continue exploring the Heart Sutra. So I will do so. Thanks for the idea. Do you all know the Heart Sutra? Anyone never heard of the Heart Sutra? Really? One. Heart Sutra, so much could be said, but it's a short chant that we often do in these Zen centers about so-called emptiness. And that's kind of the heart of the Heart Sutra, is the teaching of, well, all things are empty, the sutra says, and therefore there's no body and mind and eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and so on. That's how the sutra goes. It's a long list of negations that of all these phenomena that appear in this world. Yeah. But that can be difficult to understand what that means, because there are eyes and ears and nose, right? So they appear. So there's several new translations and interpretations of the Heart Sutra that address this point. So Thich Nhat Hanh is one of them. Thich Nhat Hanh feels like it's too much to just negate everything like that. He says it's very easily misunderstood to be kind of nihilistic, like, well, there's nothing. So Thich Nhat Hanh did a new translation of the Heart Sutra. You maybe know that Thich Nhat Hanh is currently...
still in a coma?
He's not in a coma, but he was in a coma from a brain hemorrhage, and he can kind of like see people and smile a little, but he can't talk, and it's, I think, unknown whether he'll recover. If so, it will take a long time. So keep Thich Nhat Hanh in our hearts. And before he had this difficulty, but not so long ago, he did a new translation of the Heart Sutra. And so he still kept the word emptiness, but he said in emptiness, body and mind and so on are not separate self entities. Instead of saying there's no body and mind, he said in emptiness, body and mind are not separate self entities. That's how he liked to interpret the sutra. Which is easier to take than there's no body and mind. Just that they're not separate self-entities. And to carry this even further, Kaz Tanahashi, whose talk we recently heard, retranslates this word emptiness as boundlessness. So...
actually, it's part of our liturgy. We have two English translations. The old, the original one. Was it San Francisco Zen Center?
And
Katagiri's and here.
And then that Kaz.
And then Kaz's, yeah.
Kaz and Joan Halifax.
Together
translated. And as he said, they wanted to make it, it's maybe, they wouldn't even call it exactly a translation, but like a kind of interpretation of the Heart Sutra that makes it as accessible as is possible for such a profound teaching, and designed to be read by somebody who'd never heard about Buddhism and all these ideas. And I think they did a pretty good job of, they said almost every word in the more standard translations, they questioned and came up with a new translation for. Even the word bodhisattva, they I think he is. Even that was translated as, instead of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, it was Avalokiteshvara, who helps all to awaken, which is what a Bodhisattva is. So, boundlessness. So we have this word in Sanskrit, shunyata. It's usually translated as emptiness. And apparently the etymology of shunya is like, one aspect of it anyway, is that it's like to swell, or like swollen, which is, sounds quite different from empty or void. But I think it's a nice etymology to consider, something being like, maybe particularly the image of like a balloon, a swollen balloon. It's like, it's big and appears like a big entity, but actually there's nothing inside it but space. So it's swollen, but then nothing inside it. And sometimes in the old Indian sutras, they use images like that, like a plantain tree, which we maybe don't know what those are like, but in India, they maybe understood that plantain trees are like, they look like big solid trees, but inside the trunk is hollow. So that, something about this aspect of something appears big and solid, but at its core, there's nothing there. Swollen. So that's one aspect of this word, shunya, empty, or shunyata is emptiness. So boundless, or no boundaries, I think is a nice angle on this word as a translation. Boundaries, or divisions between things, is what's being pointed to. So in reality, deepest realm of reality, there aren't really like boundaries or distinctions between things. That's a conceptual thing we make. So like, there's like, you could say there's the cup on the floor, and there's this boundary between them. The dividing line between the cup and the floor is the place where they meet. It's kind of like a boundary between the cup and the floor, a boundary or division. But it's somewhat arbitrary when we say that boundary. I mean, it's convenient, of course, to say that, because then we can say, pass me the cup, and it doesn't, like, you don't drag the whole floor along with it. We understand that there's a, we mean, by cup, we mean that the, this particular thing separate from the floor. But it's somewhat arbitrary in that you could say, well, there's also a boundary between like the top and the bottom of the cup, but we just, that one just doesn't seem as important to us. When we say pass the cup, we don't say please pass the two halves of the cup. It's just because, so it's not completely arbitrary, but it's somewhat arbitrary. But
even more problematic, pass the water in the cup.
Yeah. So there's another boundary between the water and the cup. And so the things usually go together out of convenience. But then we believe, this is, I think, the point, is then we believe there's an actual division between the water and the cup and the cup and the floor. Whereas it's no more a division than between the top and the bottom of the cup, really. It's just, we're habituated to seeing it as more of a division because of convenience. So, between my body and the floor, or between the cup and space, or this body and the space around it, you could say there's, we feel like I'm a self-entity separate from the space I'm in, but but that edge, that boundary apparent boundary between like the edge of the skin and the space is we give maybe too much weight to that division between the skin and the air, and therefore then we feel like we're separate. Whereas from this larger perspective, if we don't conceptually break things down into divided, separate entities, it's all just like one flow of stuff. This is in the material, so-called material world, right? It's actually, there aren't really divisions between things. There's stuff floating around that, appears to be divided in this way by our conceptual minds. And it causes trouble for us. Like we feel separate from the whole universe because of this projected boundary. So emptiness is a teaching to free us from that sense of separation, painful sense of separation. So instead of saying emptiness, meaning empty of independent existence, this is what emptiness usually means, independent, separate existence. Instead of saying that, Kaas and Joan Halifax say boundlessness. In boundlessness, well, we might say there's no body and mind in boundlessness, but they go even further. Already that's pretty good. We might be able to see how with no boundaries or divisions, there's no separate body, mind, floor, and cup. But they want to question this thing of saying no body, no mind. So the translation of that part of the sutra, instead of saying in emptiness there's no form, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness, how we sometimes translate, they say in boundlessness is not limited by form, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. Boundlessness is not limited by, I think that's a nice way of saying this too. In boundlessness, there's no body and mind, but it's even more embracing, maybe, to say boundlessness is not limited by these divisions into body and mind, and so on. And then, not limited by, that instead of no, later in the translation, where they say no eyes, no ears, no nose, Kaas and Joan translated as, it is free, emptiness, or boundlessness, right, is free of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Free from. Boundlessness is free from the divisions into all these things, which I think is also nice because it doesn't like negate the appearance of like the cup and the floor and me and you and body and mind. It's just that boundlessness is free from those things. Those things can still appear to be, but boundlessness is free from that. We could even say free from the like bondage of being like stuck in these separate entities. Boundlessness, and in Chinese, when they translated shunyata, emptiness, boundlessness, into Chinese, they used the Chinese character for sky. So that also has a feeling of like empty space, but boundless. Like there's no, almost like a physical image, as opposed to a philosophical abstraction. Kind of nice. Sky or air or space, which has no edges or boundaries. And it also space or sky contains everything in it. And it looks certain ways, like we look up at it on a day like this and it's blue. But if you look down from space, from outer space, from the moon, there is no blue sky. It's kind of an illusion for Earth dwellers, created by certain conditions, that blueness. So in Zen, we have some ways of talking about the Heart Sutra. Hakuin, it has a commentary, Zen words for the heart, or literally in Japanese, it's like poison words for the heart. And poison meaning like, you know, all words are a little bit poisonous because words are what divide things into, you know, pass me the cup, and it don't drag the floor along with it. You know, as soon as we say cup, we've made a boundary of some self-entity. So it's poison words, but we have to use them. So one of the most wonderful hearts of the Heart Sutra, I think, is this section, often translated as form is not different from emptiness. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. The non-duality of the appearing world and boundlessness. The non-duality of cups and floors and the non-divided, boundless, inconceivable oneness of all. So here, Hakuin, this is a little bit of Hakuin's style of very direct and kind of sarcastically critical of the whole sutra, in a way. It's kind of his style. Of course, he loves the sutra, but he's kind of, this is just his personality. So, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Or, cause actually, I think, says, the body is no other than boundlessness. Boundlessness is no other than body. Maybe he says form, but Thich Nhat Hanh says body. So, Hakuin's comment is, a nice hot kettle of stew, he ruins it by dropping a couple of rat turds in. So here we are, like, living in a nice hot kettle of stew called the inconceivable universe, radiant light that we live in the midst of, nice hot kettle of stew. But he, or I guess the Buddha, or Avalokiteshvara, who's teaching the sutra, ruins it by dropping a couple of rat turds in. Two rat turds. One called form and one called emptiness. Just commenting on this, there's this inconceivable universe that poison words can't really touch, but then the sutra's trying to express this. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form that ruins the soup. These rat turds called form and emptiness. Hakuin goes on, it's no good pushing delicacies at a person with a full belly. Striking aside waves to look for water when the waves are water. Classic image of form and emptiness, form being like the waves are part of the water, but they appear as separate waves with boundaries between the waves, but actually just one body of water. Then he has a little verse, Hakuin has a little verse here. Forms don't hinder emptiness. Emptiness is the tissue of form. Emptiness isn't the destruction of form. Form is the flesh of emptiness. Inside the Dharma gates where form and emptiness are not two, a lame turtle with painted eyebrows stands in the evening breeze. classic Zen talk. A lame turtle with painted eyebrows stands in the evening breeze. So, lame in that it's like, this turtle can't do anything, but it looks very pretty with painted eyebrows. Doesn't do anything, but it vividly appears. There's no actual real separate cup that like functions at, in its cupness, but it appears as a beautiful M. Lee's cup, established in 1955. How poisonous. And then in Zen, there's many Zen stories about this relationship of body and boundlessness, form and emptiness. Like one time, Dongshan, the founder of our Soto lineage in ancient China, was sitting in the cold Zendo in the winter, and a monk came up and said, when cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? It's freezing in here, or it's sweltering hot in here. When cold and heat come, and this means, you know, anything difficult, and the realm of separation, death and birth,
or passion and detachment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cold and heat. Yeah, that's another good one. Mm-hmm. Cold and heat. You know, I feel kind of dead. It's kind of like I have no life energy. How can I avoid that? Or I'm like too excited here in this heat of the moment. Any kind of cold and heat, anything challenging to us, the phenomena of the world, when cups and floors come, how can we deal with them? When heat and cold come, how can we avoid them? Or usually that's how we think of things, is avoiding them. Maybe a more broad, open way of asking the question is, how can we be free from them? And Dongshan said, well, why don't you go to the place where there is no hot and cold? Which, for those like that monk who knew that well, the Heart Sutra, you might say, yeah, that's the realm of the Heart Sutra, where there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no hot and no cold. Why don't you go there in emptiness, where there's none of that, and then you're free from these difficult hot and cold. So when heat and cold come, how can we be free from them? And Dongshan says, why don't you go to where there is no hot and cold? And the monk says, well, where is that? What's the place where there is no cold and heat? And Dongshan says, when it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you. And that's just a Zen way of talking. Kind of dramatic. I don't think it means literally. It, like, you freeze to death. It's like, it's so, you're so completely cold that the cold kills off you as a separate from the cold. You merge with the cold. You're completely one with the cold, and then the cold has, in a way, killed you. Now there's just cold. There's no separation from the cold or the heat. So I might, in spirit of cause, reinterpreting these sutras like this, I might say it like, if I was Dongshan, I might say it as, where's the place where there's no cold and heat? When it's cold, be completely one with the cold. When it's hot, be completely one with the heat. or completely be the cold, completely be the heat. No separation. And that is, kind of ironically, but wonderfully, the freedom from cold and heat is not some nihilistic emptiness where we don't feel anything. The place where there's no cold and heat is completely cold, completely heat, and no making it into a painful idea. It feels so cold in here. I can't deal with it anymore. It's because I'm a little bit separate from it. Of course, if this doesn't negate putting on a sweater. If it's uncomfortable, but but the practice of becoming one with our experience, I think, is the heart of the Heart Sutra, and where emptiness itself is form, completely form. These can't be separate. Complete cold is freedom from the painful difficulty of cold being a little separate from me. What I also could call the middle way. So, of course, this is all kind of like sort of abstract Zen ideas, right? But the implications are boundless. Because all day long we're making these distinctions, and every time we're having a difficulty, it's I would propose is because there's like a me separate from the situation or the experience. So, and we believe in this now the separate entity. So like, if it's cold. You could say we can turn on the heat, but in the realm of cause and effect, the middle way of cause and effect, there's effects to turning on the heat. Like, this is nice that you gather wood. Maybe some of the wood comes from the forest around here, or does all the Jacoti wood come from elsewhere?
No, it
comes from here.
Yeah, so neighbors.
Gathering the local wood that's already fallen, probably, and using that as fuel. Still, there's an effect. It puts some particles into the atmosphere, but it's a nice way to like take care of what's around. Wood's a renewable resource, but unfortunately, like a lot of us, I don't have access to like wood on our land, so then we gotta burn fossil fuels, and there's an effect, right? Like, we could say possibly the most major effect that's ever happened on the planet from trying to escape cold in the particular way that's like trying to avoid the unpleasant sensation of cold, and maybe even more so heat in like, you know, California, Central California, we don't have such an issue, but like in Florida, my parents live in Florida, and like the air conditioner is on like 24/7 most of the year, pretty much the whole year. How can we escape the heat? Well, we can just look for shade and sweat, but that might be too uncomfortable, so we'll burn the fossil fuels. So I think this is, so there are major implications if we can, like, we don't want to get into causing a lot of pain to ourselves by shivering in the cold, but maybe there's appropriate responses to, like, well, let's take a look at what the cold is. It's like, it's this idea that you have to heat the air more, instead of like wearing more layers, based on this idea that cold is unpleasant and I it's separate from me. Whereas if we just be that cold, add layers as needed, but like if it's kind of cool, it's kind of okay. So it may be that like by opening to this, to just merging with our experience and not getting overly into like manipulating it. I think we do manipulate it some by wearing clothes and so on. But watching how we do that is one implication of the Heart Sutra. Any questions or comments or thoughts about all this?
I had two thoughts. One is we were talking about the blue and the
swollen,
the explanation of the expanding universe and of space and time itself, sort of blowing up as the surface expands. So that was kind of
And that actually, is there anything really? I guess with a balloon, as it gets bigger, there's more air molecules filling it, but in a way it's just like it's space. Is there more or less of space? I could say there's more space, but it's only, you only call that because of the division of this outer layer. And I don't know, like the outer layer of the universe, like the thin rubber boundary of the universe, what is that? If the universe is like a balloon, and maybe that's why we can't say it's more, it just gets inconceivable because there's no boundary of the universe, right? Although they say it's expanding, which implies there's a boundary that's getting bigger. It must be expanding into something, but that doesn't make
space
sense.
Space itself is expanding.
Space itself, but our conceptual way of understanding expansion, right, is like there's an edge. You know, what is what would be expansion without an edge that's expanding into something? That's like mind blowing. And yet, this is a nice, any way we contemplate the universe is mind blowing. I think when we really start approaching it, whether it's expanding or not, it's just like, what's the boundary? You could say that if there's no boundary, that's inconceivable. There must, if you keep going, how can there be no end? And yet if there is an end, then what's beyond that? I think just the contemplation of that is enough to relax our kind of narrow, like,
our skin bag concept.
Yeah. Like, we're dealing with cups and floors and stuff, but, like, when we start thinking in that way, it's like, okay.
But doesn't that mean the skin bag has no edges, too?
Well, it's true. I mean, the skin bag, it's not necessarily expanding unless we, like, eat a lot. Expanding. But, that's the thing. Is it Abraham Maslow, I think, had this term, the skin-encapsulated ego? Mm-hmm. Does anyone know that? I think he might have had that, coined this term, meaning, like, we think that that inside the skin is, like, ourself, and outside is not. But I think he's pointing at, that's a little bit arbitrary. Mm-hmm. Again, I would say not completely arbitrary, because there's conditions for why we perceive that way, of course. But it's not definitively, it's just conditions that create the perception and strong feeling that me is inside the skin and not outside the skin. But it's not like a fixed, definitive reality. Because sometimes we even experience in zazen, maybe like really deeply settled in zazen, and feel quite strongly as if, like, we don't feel the edge of the body anymore. And we might feel our kind of, like, awareness kind of expanding into the room or the whole world in a somewhat, like, way that can feel maybe more valid than the skin-encapsulated ego.
That leads back to a question I had during your talk, was that we're talking about feeling, perception, formations, consciousness, you know, all these things are not limited by, and so it seems like...
Or more that boundlessness is not limited by those things.
Boundlessness is not limited by these things, because we have, there's kind of like this, there's more of a selfish mode of feeling, you know, like kleshas and attachment and all that kind of stuff. But it seems like there's a feeling component to what you just described too, that's, you know, it may move through emotions at times, but it's deeper and not limited by.
You mean like the feeling of like awareness pervading the room?
There's a felt sense.
There's a felt sense, but we could say that in boundlessness is not even limited by our felt sense of that. So our, in a way, our felt sense of that is nice, because it gives us a little, it seems more in the direction of reality than like the skin encapsulated ego, but it's still limited. That's why Dogen is so emphasizes, like, he kind of de-emphasizes like tangible enlightenment experiences that have a certain feeling or concept to them, and emphasizes more like, you know, everything is interpenetrating everything else, but all this does not appear within our perception. It's unconstructedness and boundless. So like anything that we can even feel is a little bit like limited.
Or rattered.
Rattered.
That does have the sort of connotation that boundlessness begins to sound like a separate, maybe a substance or an ether that fills everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So maybe it's from a source, and maybe it's really not part of us.
Mm. That's the nice thing. Yeah, space, I think, definitely has a sense. Sometimes we talk about the space-like quality, and that has a kind of ether-like, substance-like feeling. Boundlessness is pretty good, because it is another negation, actually, right? It's the absence of boundaries. Mm-hmm. So generally, I think that's why there's all this negation going on in the Prajnaparamita, is that it leaves less to hold on, make into something. So boundlessness is a little less graspable than space, actually, in terms of this kind of ether-like substance. Just that boundless...